Hello again, everyone. Welcome back to part two of our powder keg of a podcast. It's the Extra Point Podcast, and it's part two of the one we began yesterday. And so today is Wednesday, August 20th, and I want to answer the final questions that came in. And so be aware, this is from the Message Sunday. Like I said in the first podcast or the first part of this podcast, it'll be very helpful if you hear the message. We do make a number of assumptions, both in the questions and in the answers. And so, again, on today, just make sure that you've heard the message, and we'll dive right into these questions that came in from Sunday's time in the Word. Next question, I think it's question five. This person asked a very insightful question regarding the word shame. It's in the passage. They ask this: how do we reconcile the verses that speak to the fact that Christ took our shame and guilt on the cross? We no longer bear that shame and guilt, and yet it's often a tool the enemy uses to try and invalidate the work on the cross. What they're asking is, the verse seems to say that we should enact a level of separation at times so that they feel shame. And I think the word's tough to hear, admittedly. They're saying, what about the verses that say that Christ took our shame? Well, I want to answer the question. The person asked, how do we reconcile this verse in 2 Thessalonians 3 with the verses about Christ taking our shame? Here's how we reconcile it. First of all, by understanding the tense of the word. Now, listen very carefully. When Christ took our shame, and he did, by the way, he took all of our shame, all of our guilt. What he did was he removed from us the penalty of our sin. And so when we believe, that's removed, and we are no longer lingering under that penalty. Our shame that we once had under that penalty is gone because Christ took it. We no longer bear it. We have believed in Christ. So there's no lingering penalty. So in that sense, when we speak of Christ taking our shame, it is a past tense issue. He took our shame. We've believed in him. And so it doesn't linger. We don't live worried that we're going to bear the penalty of our sin, that we're going to endure the wrath of God. We have no shame. Christ took it. We're free. There's no lingering penalty. But when it talks about shame in 2 Thessalonians, there it's shame for the believer who is in a present tense of disobedience. And it's not concerning a lingering penalty. It's really concerning a dishonored relationship. And in that passage, of course, shame refers to this type of dishonored moment when the Lord's name and the Lord's body are looked at wrongly because of someone's actions. And what needs to be felt is grief over the damage done to both of those entities, Christ's name and Christ's body. That's what shame's referring to there. And I can't take it out of the CSB. There are other words used, and the word has, you know, a variation of meanings. But this is not a bad translation. I think we can often be uncomfortable with it, but it simply refers to an understanding that you've dishonored something, and so there's grief over that. But that grief, or that shame is the word used, that shame is not over a lingering penalty. We don't think we're going to be judged by God for our sin anymore. We're realizing we have dishonored a relationship, that we've broken fellowship, and that grieves us. So that's the shame talked about here. So that's how we reconcile these two verses. When Christ removed our shame, he did remove the penalty. It no longer lingers over us. It's past tense. It's done. This shame in 2 Thessalonians refers to a broken or dishonored relationship, and it's in the present tense. And it's a grief over damage done to both the Lord's name and the Lord's body through actions that are sinful. And so in that moment, we do want there to be grief and an awareness that we've brought dishonor to those two things. That's a present tense situation over a relationship. What Christ redeemed us from and delivered us from was the lingering penalty of death. So they are different. They can be differentiated. And I think that's how you reconcile these two verses. Question number six, what if your spouse asks you not to say something to the sinner? And I think by sinner, they mean the persistently disobedient one. So the scenario, you're going to have this conversation of confrontation. your spouse says, oh, don't do that. And the spouse must lay out all the repercussions. And they're wondering, what do you do? Well, I'll tell you my opinion on this. I think your first responsibility is to your spouse. So I'd say don't have the conversation. I don't think that's neglect. I don't think that's a lack of courage. I think it's probably wisdom and discretion. I'm assuming in this, of course, that the motives of your spouse are good. They're not running from something, but trying to actually protect something else. Maybe there's other things in play and they're aware of them. So they're asking you, could you find a different way? And so I would really trust the Lord in that moment, honor your spouse, and just ask God if there's another person that could step up and do this. I'm not sure I would try to find the person or recruit the person, but just trust the Lord, pray. And I say your first responsibility is to your spouse. And then what I'd say is this, maybe give it a month and then revisit that with your spouse. Is if nothing's happened with the persistently disobedient person and you still feel this need to have that conversation of confrontation, revisit with your spouse and see if they're any different on where they were. But to answer the question, I think you owe it to your spouse first, and I wouldn't have the conversation. Question 7. If someone has struggled with a persistent sin in the past, and you've been through this process with them a couple of times, and they have a moment where they give in to the temptation again, and this keeps happening over and over, do you recommend going through this process again? Or what would you recommend? And is it any different when the person is not just a member of your spiritual family, but an actual family member? Well, I would say this. I would be open and probably suggest that you repeat this. I think that could be helpful. I don't know how many times, but I think the process is helpful and can reinforce itself if you continue to stay at it with someone. However, I would not repeat it forever, okay? Now, hear this well, and I've said this before, that patience is still patience even when it has an expiration date. I do believe long-suffering or patience is long, so you can keep repeating this, but it's not wrong when things like this have an expiration date. It's not true in those moments that you're impatient. It's just simply admitting your patience ran out. I remind you that God is patient and long-suffering. But you know, when his son, Christ, returns, that'll be the end of the opportunity to repent. So the patience of God has an expiration date in that sense. He is always patient. How he exhibits it does have a historical, and in this case, a prophetic point in time in which it will end. But that doesn't mean God isn't patient. He is. He is forever and always patient. But patience does have expiration dates. So wrestle with that as you think about how long do you repeat this and how long does this thing keep going. I think the thing to look for is progress, and I'm sure you're aware of this, but as long as there is some progress, I'd probably say just keep repeating it for the sake of every single small step. If you stop seeing any progress, that's when you want to start thinking about, well, when does this, you know, process end? But if you see any progress, if you see any small step, man, I would encourage you, keep reinforcing your commitment to restoration by repeating the process, having the conversation, letting them know, hey, listen, let's not revisit separation. Let's not have to go back to these kinds of consequences. I know we can get there. I'm with you. Let's keep pushing forward. And by God's power through his Holy Spirit, I'm confident that you can make some progress. So I would be in the corner of saying repeating it could be helpful. Now, you ask about, is it different if it's a family member, not just a spiritual church member? And the answer is yes, it is different. It looks different. If it's an immediate family member, meaning someone in your home, I don't think you can violate higher principles to enforce some kind of separation, whether it's parent to child, spouse to spouse. I think you have higher principles in play. You've got to keep all that in mind. You can't violate those to try to pursue this process. So it does look different. Even if it's an extended family, I think in that situation, like let's say with grandparents or uncles and aunts or situations like that, you've got to look for ways that separation can be felt even if it shouldn't be forced. And so the point and the driving idea of the text can still be in play, even if perhaps you're having to kind of massage how it looks, because you are in a family situation and there's some things that are just simply required to some degree that you can't change. Let me give you an example. Let's say it's one of your parents and they've recently got addicted to a drug, or maybe it's alcohol and they're now drinking really heavily, and there are moments that it's not really wise to be with them with your children. But you know there are times that you have to visit your parents, probably, and so there are ways you can make that safe and make that healthy. There are times you perhaps can't. Maybe you arrange a different schedule. Maybe you don't leave the kids with them alone any longer, but you're always there. There's just a number of different ways that you can still get the sense across that we are at a different level of relationship, even if it's not actual separation. So that's what I would say. That's how it probably looks different, is that you have to figure out how that principle of social distancing, shall we say, how that principle can be felt even if you can't force it. Now, before I end today, let me provide one final observation. It's not a question from someone, but it does pertain to a conversation I had after the service with one of our elders, and we were discussing this whole family correction process laid out in 2 Thessalonians and how it seems very uncommon, and yet, quite frankly, in the text, it's quite plain. And we were asking ourselves, what is the method people use then to solve problems, and what seems to be predominantly common? And unfortunately, his observation was that people are probably more passive-aggressive than anything. Like, that seems to be the go-to activity when things get difficult, when there needs to be some separation, or there needs to be some confrontation, or that they wish there was restoration, but they don't want to have the conversation. He said it seems like they just simply shut down, walk away, say one thing but do another. Often any kind of passive-aggressive behavior, it's an avoidance tactic when you act like things are okay, and yet they're really not. Now, there's a lot to that. I'm not a passive-aggressive expert, but I do know what he's talking about, and I tended to agree with him. That seems to be a posture adopted in the American church as a way to solve a lot of problems without having to face anyone or have an honest conversation or a difficult confrontation, and is not helpful or healthy in the long run. Often we find people who adopt victim mentalities, and they have this martyr complex. And so all these things, what they do is, when those are the kind of postures we adopt, instead of one in which we try to work through issues plainly, truthfully, compassionately, when we adopt passive-aggressive postures, it really allows baggage to collect, it allows bitterness to take root, and eventually that the fruit from that is born, and the relationships do suffer. The problem is, in the short term, you think you feel better about the situation because you're not having to face anything difficult. No hard conversations, nothing like that has to happen. And so it appears that things are okay, but the long-term effect is very detrimental. And what you have really is a choice between short-term pain and long-term gain. That's what comes with the biblical family correction process. Or if you trade that in for some type of passive-aggressive behavior, you really have short-term gain, but you have long-term pain. And so I just want to make this observation. If the tendency is perhaps to resort to passive-aggressive behavior, victim mentalities, saying one thing but actually doing another, or pretending, or hiding, or simply being deceptive and manipulative in ways that appear that you're actually trying to, be sacrificial or something like that, just resist those. Don't give in to those. Instead, really commit to this process laid out in 2 Thessalonians. And when you do, be willing to have what I call face value communication. That's the term that Julie and I have used for a number of years, and it just simply refers to the willingness to speak the truth in love at every turn. And this does take practice. It takes time. But if you keep trying and keep working at it, you will adopt it. It'll become a habit. And it really, over time, builds trust. It builds openness. And it builds confidence in both communication and expectation. Face value communication, learning to answer every question as truthfully as you can, as politely as you can, learning to ask questions that actually are designed to ask what you want to know. They're not in code. They're not an end around, or you're not working around something to get to something else. So whether you're asking the question, seeking information, or answering the question, the ability to speak with plain and simple truth, what I call face value communication, that the person who's hearing can take you at your word. What you say is what you mean. You'll speak that plainly. And you'll ask those kind of questions when you're curious about something. Face value communication is the way to communicate when you're involved in family correction in the spiritual family. And that's far better than passive-aggressive postures or passive-aggressive behavior. And this elder and I were just commenting that it does seem like often we choose the world's methods when we really should choose the Bible's. And I don't think that's always intentional on everyone's part. We probably are watching it happen. We see things and we kind of copy what we see. But we have to be very intentional to adopt biblical practices and not to let the world's practices seep in and become habits that we're not even aware of. So let's commit to family correction done with face value communication, and let's resist the temptation to get to an end result through passive aggressive behavior. Like I said, a powder keg of a podcast, I'm confident that there are folks who will disagree with some things I've said. I'm even confident that some things I've said, I might have a different opinion after talking to some of you or given some time rethinking it. These are areas that are difficult to navigate, but it's helpful and wise for us to think through them, provide some perspective, offer some, best next steps, and then with humility, trust the Lord, stay close to His Word, stay close to His church, and let's walk together through moments where family correction is in play, and when it's difficult to navigate, let's trust the Lord and one another and lean on His Word. And know that God will give us grace to make it to the other side.
Thanks for listening to the Extra Point Podcast. To find more content and resources to grow deeper in your relationship with Jesus, go online to firstfamily.church/resources.